Well, today in our series on the book of Acts, we are going to go through a lot of material and hit some highlights and then spend a little more time talking about a 2-year span of time now in the Apostle Paul's life when things went badly after his arrest in Jerusalem. We tend to think, well, you know, this is the modern age. We are civilized people, and that explains why life is better for us now than it was for, say, people 500 years ago, 1,000 years ago, whatever, in Bible times. But technically, without the influence of Jesus on a life, there is no gentling of society. And I'd like to remind you of this reality by using an example that you all are familiar with. This is Chairman Mao. He's the communist dictator in China until his death in 1976. So he's a modern person, right? He's not from the old days. He's a modern person. He's a contemporary personality. But how gentle was he? How civilized was he? He said when he was taking control of China, he said, "Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun." That was his philosophy. He said, "Half of China may well have to die for me to institute my policies." And in fact, somewhere between 45 and 75 million Chinese people did die under his policies. He said, "From now on, it'll be illegal to have fewer than 3 persons in any bedroom. You have to have 3 or more persons in a bedroom." Well, obviously, that is going to have implications for family life. Students in many schools, while he looked on approvingly, students in many schools dragged their teachers and principals out into the street and beat them, forcing them to renounce their corrupt elitism as the educational class, and oftentimes killing them in these beatings. And many of the students actually then cooked and cannibalized these teachers in celebration of overcoming their oppressors, the bourgeoisie class. And all of this under Chairman Mao's watchful eye. He approved it. He was glad. And he didn't want the violence to end. He never brushed his teeth. According to his personal physician, he was Chairman Mao's personal physician for 22 years. He said, "Chairman Mao never brushed his teeth and his teeth turned green. There was pus visible on his infected gums when he would smile. He never took baths, recalling that Chinese peasants only took 3 baths in their lives. The day they were born, the day before they got married, and the day of their death." And he thought that was a good idea. He slept with innumerable very young women, giving many of them the STD that he carried. While he was being interviewed by a female reporter, he purposely picked body lice off and plucked them away just to be obnoxious. Amazingly, in spite of, you know, his barbarism, other nations wanted to emulate him. They wanted to copy his policies. And so in Cambodia in 1975, that wasn't so long ago, right? In 1975, the Communist Party in Cambodia copied Maoism, and they killed nearly 1/4 of Cambodia's population in just 4 years. They turned against the educated class, and they moved entire populations of the city into labor camps. And that was Cambodia trying to follow the wonderful example. And not so long ago, right? In Peru in the 1980s, the Communist Party there, called the Shining Path, endorsed their own brand of Maoism. And they came out and said, "Our position is very clear. We reject and condemn human rights." We don't want them. We don't want human rights to be here. And they became the most horrifying guerrilla movement in Latin American history. And that's saying something in Latin America. So there's nothing magical about living in the 1970s or the 1990s or the early 2000s that would make us think that a person is going to be gentle. The thing that makes a person gentle is if he personally has decided to follow the gentle Messiah, or if he is living in the midst of so many people who have been touched by the gentle Messiah that he himself thinks, yeah, gentleness is a good way to go. But there's nothing about the age in which we live that makes a person gentle. And today we're going to talk about the resurrection going to court. The last time we left the Apostle Paul on the streets of Jerusalem, where he was being carried off by the Roman army because there was a riot and all the Jewish people were trying to kill him for being a heretic. And so that's kind of where we left off. He was arrested. Now, what we're going to see is after he is arrested in the book of Acts, from the end of chapter 22, throughout chapter 23, 24, 25, 26, this is a 2-year period of time. And in this 2 years, he is going to be in jail the entire time. 2 years in jail. And then he has 4 appearances in court. So 2 years in jail, 4 appearances in court. And what you're going to see is that basically the resurrection is on trial. The resurrection goes to court. Because Paul says in each of these situations, he's saying, what's really happening here? I have not committed any crimes. The Jewish people hate the idea that Messiah is resurrected. And that's why there was a riot. And that's why I was arrested. And that's why I'm still here for 2 years in jail. All right. So the first court proceeding, number one there, was before the Jewish Sanhedrin. And this is basically chapter 23. And Paul is going to defend himself before the most important Jewish court of the land. And here he says in verse 6, men and brethren, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. And remember, that means that he has Jewish pedigree that is perfect. I mean, he is the real deal. He said, there's nobody here more Jewish than I am. All right, so men and brothers, Jewish brothers, I am a Pharisee, the son of a Pharisee. And here's what he says. I am being judged concerning the hope and resurrection of the dead. That's what this is all about. I didn't do anything wrong. I'm here because the resurrection is on trial. That's the truth. Then in chapter 23, verse 9, half of the Jewish council believes in the possibility of resurrection. Half of the Jewish council does not believe in the possibility of resurrection. When Paul says this, those two factions start to fight and they get in a big row. And eventually the Pharisees on the council say, we find no evil in this man. He didn't do anything wrong. It's important. At all of these 4 trials, this is what's going to be said. He didn't do anything wrong. All right. So here the Pharisees rose up in dispute saying, we find no evil in this man. But if a spirit or an angel has spoken to him, let us not fight against God. So remember, the resurrection went to trial. And the first verdict is, Paul didn't do anything wrong. Nothing we can do about this. All right, trial number 2. Next, he goes before Felix. He's the Roman governor in Caesarea. Caesarea is a little bit north of Jerusalem. And they had to whisk Paul out of Jerusalem because there was an influential group of Jewish people who went into a pact that they would absolutely assassinate Paul the first chance they got. So the Roman government heard about this and they escorted under armed guard, escorted Paul up to Caesarea where things would be much more level, much cooler. And so now Felix is not a Jewish person, right? He's a Roman governor. And Paul is accused with starting a riot. And so he goes to court. And once again, notice what happens in chapter 24, verse 20. Paul says, let these same people hear my accusers. Let these same people here say if they have found any evil doing in me. Like, did I do anything wrong? You know, tell me what it is. And then he says, here's why I'm here. I am being judged by you today concerning the resurrection of the dead. That's the point. That's why I'm here. Resurrection has gone to trial. Paul says that's what all of this is about. And nothing else. No other charges are going to stick. No other charges matter. I'm here about the topic of Jesus being resurrected from the dead. That's why this is happening. In chapter 24, verse 22, Felix, again, remember he's the governor of Caesarea, a Roman deputy, not Jewish. When Felix heard these things, he postponed them and said, well, when Lysias, the chief captain who arrested you in Jerusalem during the riot, when he comes here, I'll hear more about this. I'll know the full story, the uttermost of the matter. And so once again, trial number 2, we don't see that he did anything wrong. All right, trial number 3. This one is very brief, and we don't have a lot of information on it. So we see that he is now before a new governor in Caesarea. So Felix has a term, the term has ended, and now Festus takes over that same office, okay? So it's sort of the same thing, but a new governor, and the new governor wants to hear what's going on. So in chapter 25, verse 9, we don't know a lot of the dialogue, but here's what it comes to. the governor says to Paul, "Do you wish to go up to Jerusalem and be judged there?" Paul says, "No, I do not. Those people keep trying to kill me. I do not wish to go there." So verse 10, then Paul said, "I stand at Caesar's judgment. You know, you are Roman governors. I want to be judged by Roman governors. I stand at Caesar's judgment seat where I ought to be judged. I appeal to Caesar." And so Festus says, "Well, have you appealed to Caesar? To Caesar you shall go." Excuse me. And in verse 25, he is explaining what took place in that trial. And he says, "When I found that he had committed nothing worthy of death," nothing worthy of death here, "and that he himself has appealed to Augustus, I determined to send him." So in no case has Paul done anything wrong. He says the whole point is resurrection. One more trial. Trial before Herod Agrippa II. Herod is half Jewish. And he knows about Jewish things. So he knows what takes place in Jerusalem. He knows about the riot. He knows all about it. So in chapter 26, verse 6. And by the way, this is trial in quotation marks, because it has already been determined that Paul is going to go to Rome and be judged by the Roman courts. So that's already determined. But Herod just wants to hear this. So you might say this is a trial. You might say this is just sort of an interview. At any rate, it feels like a trial. So in chapter 26, verse 6, the Apostle Paul is speaking to Herod and with a whole group of dignitaries watching. He says, "And now I am judged for the hope of the promise made by God, for which I am accused of the Jews. Why should it be thought incredible by you that God should raise the dead?" So one more time. Paul says, this has always been about the resurrection. "I am in court over the resurrection of Jesus. Why do you Jewish people who accuse me think it's impossible for God to raise people from the dead? You know, why are you doing this?" And what is the outcome? In chapter 26, verse 31, when they've gone aside, they talk between themselves saying, "This man is doing nothing worthy of death or bonds. This is not a criminal we have before us." Paul says the entire thing is about resurrection. He didn't do anything criminal. And verse 32, Herod Agrippa, right, the half-Jewish person, he says to Festus, the Roman governor, he said, "This man might have been set at liberty if he had not appealed to Caesar. Like, you know, I'd be inclined to let him go right now. But since he's going to Rome, then he's going to Rome. Case closed." But what you can see from start to finish is that the resurrection went to court four times. And in every case, everybody said, "This is not about a criminal thing with Paul. This is about resurrection, and he didn't do anything wrong." All right, then we come to chapter 26, and this is where we're going to spend a little more time, his defense before Agrippa, which is a compelling speech. It's such a good speech. And he says in verse 22, "Having therefore obtained help from God, I continue unto this day witnessing both to small and great." You know, here's, since the light that hit me on the Damascus Road changed my mind. Here's what I do. I witness to large groups and small groups, important people and small people, saying nothing else than what the prophets and Moses said should come. I'm just saying what they said. That Christ, and remember, when you see the word Christ, it's the same as Messiah. It's Messiah in Hebrew, Christ in Greek, but Messiah and Christ are the same. That Messiah should suffer, and that he should be the first that should rise from the dead, and that he should show light to the people. And by that he means the Jewish people and to the Gentiles. All right? So Paul says, I'm not saying anything different than what Moses said and all the prophets have said. And Paul is speaking the truth when he says that. He said, I'm just saying what they said, that Messiah should suffer. And that is what Moses and the prophets said, right? In Daniel 9:26, "And after 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off." Cut off was the Jewish way of saying he's going to be done away with. And that could mean banished, but it could also mean executed. So Daniel says, oh yeah, Messiah is going to be executed. Paul says, I only say that which the prophets have said before me, that Messiah is going to be executed. In Isaiah 53:8, we have the same term, but with this addition. He was taken from prison and from judgment. He was cut off out of the land of the living. Oh, so we're not just talking about being banished here, right? He's killed. So Messiah is going to be cut off out of the land of the living when you make his soul an offering for sin. Everybody knows what an offering was. You know, that was you set the sacrifice on fire. They don't survive that. They're not just banished. They're killed. And so Messiah has to suffer. In Zechariah 12:4, we have, in that day declares the Lord. And I want you to remember in yellow there, who is saying this? The Lord. In that day declares the Lord, I will pour upon the house of David the spirit of grace, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, that is, whom they have stabbed. And they shall mourn for him as one mourns for his only son. And isn't that interesting? Can the Lord God, the great God of Israel, can he be stabbed? Who would stab God? How precisely would you stab God if you wanted to stab him? You see the problem. And so God has to come in the person of Messiah, and they stab him. And then after he's stabbed, they look upon him. All right. So Messiah had to suffer. He had to be stabbed. He had to be cut off out of the land of the living. He had to. That's what Moses said. And Paul says, it's just the same thing I say. And Paul says, same thing. Messiah should be the first that should rise from the dead. So Messiah has to rise from the dead. That's what Moses and the prophets said. And of course, that's right. Again, back to Daniel 9:26. After 62 weeks, Messiah shall be cut off. But afterwards, they will anoint the most holy. Well, how do you kill him and then anoint him? You know, that's not going to work, right? Unless there's resurrection. In Isaiah 53:8, he was cut off out of the land of the living, but then he shall prolong his days. Well, how do you kill him and prolong his days? You can't have it both ways, right? Either kill him or prolong his days, but you can't have it both ways unless there's resurrection. Then you could prolong his days. That's exactly what is going on. In Psalm 16:10, you will not leave my soul in hell. Okay, well, that's the invisible part of you, the soul. You will not leave my soul in hell. Neither will you allow your Holy One to see corruption. All right, so there can't be corruption. Somewhere there has to be this person who, when he dies, his soul doesn't stay dead and his body doesn't decay. Who is that person? See, Paul says, I'm only telling you what Moses and the prophets told you. It's not that different, right? And Zechariah 12:4, remember, in that day declares the Lord, I'll pour upon the house of David the spirit of grace, and they shall look upon me whom they have pierced, and they shall mourn. You're going to stab the Lord God of Israel. You're going to stab the Lord God. And then after he has been stabbed, you're going to look on him and feel badly about it. And the Lord God doesn't go away. You stabbed him and you were sorry, but he's still there. That's resurrection. Besides that, everywhere in the Bible we have this, right? We have plant life. Did you ever notice on creation week? You have God said, let there be light. And there was light. And then God has firmament. And on day three, plant life. Life comes on day three. On the third day, Jesus was raised from the dead. Day three in creation week is life. Jesus came back to life the third day. Abraham thought resurrection would be the solution to Isaac's sacrifice, which is why he was willing to take Isaac up on the mountain of Moriah. And offer him there. But as he leaves his traveling party, he says, you all wait here while the lad and I go yonder to worship, and then we will return. So Abraham knew that he's supposed to go up on that mountain and kill his son. And he said, and then the lad and I are going to come back. The only way you can both kill your son and come back is if you think there's going to be a resurrection. Well, as it turns out, Isaac didn't get killed on the mountain, but Abraham thought that that's what was going to take place. That's resurrection. Celebration of harvest every Sunday of Passover week. So, you know, you have a Passover week is 7 days. In the middle of that week somewhere, there's going to be a Sunday. On that Sunday is the Feast of First Fruits, right after Passover, Feast of First Fruits. And on the Feast of First Fruits, you are celebrating the harvest. When you put a seed in the ground, and then it comes back to life with harvest. Every single Passover, we have a celebration of harvest. And Jesus came back from the grave on Sunday, Passover week. You see, it's there everywhere. And we could talk about Aaron's rod that budded, and we can talk about many other such things. And so that's resurrection. Paul says, I haven't told you anything else but what Moses and the prophets talked about. What is the problem here? And then in verse 26, as he's talking to King Herod Agrippa, remember he's half Jewish, so he's aware. And here the Apostle Paul says, for the king knows of these things, before whom also I speak freely. For I am persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him. You know, Herod, you know the commotion around the empty tomb. You know very well. You know about the riot when I was arrested. You know all about these things. You know perfectly well what took place. The king knows of these things, before whom also I speak freely, for I'm persuaded that none of these things are hidden from him. For this thing was not done in a corner. It's not like this was a little secret thing and nobody knew anything about it. This was news, and he knows all about it. And this reminds us then, as the resurrection is on trial, what did Herod know? Now, some of the things we're going to show you are from the future, so he wouldn't know the future. But he knew all these things that were bubbling over since that first day when there was a great commotion at the tomb of Jesus, the empty tomb of Jesus. If there were not inexplicable happenings at the tomb of Jesus that day, then, for all of us, why does the entire world date everything around the career of Jesus Christ? If nothing in particular is important about the career of Jesus Christ, why do all of us today date everything around the career of Jesus Christ? Something must have happened that was really big in the career of Christ, particularly the resurrection. And if inexplicable happenings did not occur on that day, then how and why did the religion of Jesus single-handedly instigate equality for rich and poor, male and female, healthy and disabled, majority and minority races? Where does this equality come from? You say, well, I guess we just evolved, you know? We're just not like that anymore. Well, did Chairman Mao evolve? Did Pol Pot in Cambodia evolve? It has nothing to do with evolving. It has to do with whether there is a critical mass of people around you who have been touched by the influence of the resurrected Messiah. And if nothing in particular happened around Jesus' tomb, then what did Paul see that day on the road to Damascus that totally changed his life so that he's willing to die for the truth of the resurrection? Nobody doubts. You know, you could go to the most skeptical university professor in America and ask him, did the Apostle Paul live? The answer will be yes. Well, did the Apostle Paul once persecute the church? Evidently. And did the Apostle Paul die believing in the resurrection? Yes. It happened. So since this change is universally acknowledged, why the change? What did happen that caused Paul to change? And if inexplicable happenings did not go on at the tomb that day, then when Peter, James, and John realized that their resurrection claims were going to cost them deeply, why didn't they just change their minds? I mean, if they're lying, and then you think, this lie isn't working out at all. This lie is making me poor. This lie is making everybody hate me. This lie is hurting me physically because they beat me and put me in prison. I don't like this lie. I'm going to change my mind. Why didn't they just change their mind? If they were lying, right? But something inexplicable must have been happening at that tomb. And if not, then why did thousands of people, and there were thousands, why did thousands of people convert to Christianity in Jerusalem, the very place where it all happened, where they could know, if anybody could know, where they could know, why did thousands of people convert to Christianity in the first few months after the resurrection? Paul says to Herod, these things weren't done in a corner, were they, King? You know. And if nothing inexplicable happened at Jesus' tomb that day, then why did Christianity spread all the way from Jerusalem to Corinth? That's 800 miles within 25 years. How do you start a new religion and have it grow exponentially in just 25 years, 800 miles away? Who would do that? And even more, why had Christianity broken out and Tacitus a Roman historian who's not a Christian. That's what he said. Oh, Christianity just broke out. Well, why did Christianity break out? Not only in Jerusalem, he says, but also even in Rome. Rome is 1,400 miles away from Jerusalem. He said, and this religion broke out not only in Jerusalem, but even in Rome, 1,400 miles away. And so much so that Nero, the emperor of the world, Nero knew who the Christians were, not just one or two in Rome. He knew it's a substantial fraction. He knew who the Christians were, and he hated them. And he hated them enough to blame the great fire of Rome on them in 64 AD. In other words, the most important man in the world knew that there were a lot of Christians, and he hated them so much that he blamed the Roman fire on them. They obviously didn't do it. And all that within 35 years of Jesus' commotion at the tomb. This is an extraordinary thing. If there weren't inexplicable happenings at the tomb that day, then why did Christianity grow to the point where the Roman government thought it necessary to commence 300 years of persecution against it? If it's just a handful of people that don't matter, why persecute it for 300 years? And what were they doing that was so wrong? Same thing that Paul did. They kept talking about resurrection. Then why, after the career of Jesus, did multitudes of Roman pagans who never had any interest in the concept of resurrection before suddenly get interested in resurrection? So now we come to the 300s AD, and all the Roman Empire believes in the resurrection. I mean, not all, of course, but it has become the official state religion. Oh, yeah, there's resurrection. And pagan people never cared about resurrection before. For thousands of years, they didn't care. Now they care. Why? What changed their minds? Why has Christianity changed so many addicts, criminals, and takers into good neighbors? If nothing particular happened at Jesus' tomb that day, then why are Christians changing from being criminals and addicts and takers to being truly good neighbors? What's going on there? And why are Christians, even to this very day, because they are, statistically, this is just true, why are Christians today more kind and generous than their non-Christian neighbors? I mean, obviously, not every single Christian is more kind and generous than his non-Christian neighbor. Not every time, but statistically. Christians give away more of their money. Christians dedicate more of their volunteer time. Christians adopt more children and foster more children. It's just the truth. That's just the way it is, statistically. When Paul was talking about this, he said, I'm just telling you the same thing that Moses and the other prophets have always said, that Messiah has to suffer, which he did, that Messiah has to rise from the dead, which he did, and that Messiah has to be a light to the Jewish people and the Gentile people. And that is what the prophets said in Isaiah 9 in Galilee. And isn't that great? Jesus comes from Galilee, the man from Galilee. In Galilee of the nations, the people who walked in darkness have seen a great light. Those who dwell in the shadow of death, upon them the light has shined. The light of Messiah, and it started in Galilee. Paul says, that's exactly what I've been saying. Isaiah 60, verse 1, your light has come, and the glory of the Lord has risen upon you. For the Lord shall rise upon you, and the Gentiles shall come to your light, and kings to the brightness of your rising. Paul said, I do a lot of work with the Gentiles because Isaiah said that the Gentiles would come to Messiah's light. It's just in the Bible. It's what all of us Jewish people have always believed. In chapter 26, verse 24, Paul, speaking to Herod, but with the governor, Festus, and a lot of other VIPs all standing around. Festus, the governor of Caesarea, he jumps up and he says with a loud voice, Paul, you are beside yourself, you know, insane. You like two personalities, multiple personalities. Paul, you are beside yourself. Much learning makes you mad. But he said, I'm not mad, most noble Festus, but I speak forth the words of truth and soberness. You know, you're a Christian. You're talking like a madman that there should be resurrection. Are you insane? And Paul says, I'm not insane. I'm speaking forth words of truth and soberness. And it's so funny because here is the resurrected Christ who has made our world a safer, more gentle place. Everybody says, oh, we Christians, we must be insane. And Paul said, I'm not insane. I'm speaking forth words of truth and soberness. It's this religion of Jesus that keeps us all from acting like Chairman Mao and Pol Pot. It doesn't matter in what year you live. It matters, has there been a critical mass of believers around you teaching you how to be gentle? That's what matters. It's the resurrected Messiah that keeps us from madness. Like this. Imagining that men can be pregnant. That's madness, you know. One of my friends posted on Facebook, if you don't think that that's madness, here's what you do. Go out and buy a lot of roosters so that you can have fresh eggs every morning. And then go buy a lot of bulls so you can have fresh milk. If you don't think that's madness, you've been detached from the resurrected Messiah. That the universe can pop into existence out of nothing. That human rights come from atheism, like Chairman Mao, or Hinduism. That Christianity was the cause of slavery and not the solution. That math is racist. That rape and violence are okay for Hamas. That fatherless and single motherhood are perfectly healthy family options. That same-sex couples should look forward to parenthood. That people who choose not to work are entitled to the money of others. That is madness. It's the truth of the resurrected Messiah that keeps us from that. And it doesn't matter in what age you live, if you live in the old Roman Empire or if you live today, it's the truth of the resurrected Christ that keeps us from this madness. Again, in his defense before Herod and Festus and VIPs, the Apostle Paul says, I have appeared to you for this purpose. That's Christ telling Paul what his purpose is. And here's Paul's purpose. To open their eyes and to turn them from darkness to light, from the power of Satan to God, that they may receive forgiveness of sins and inheritance among those who are sanctified by faith that is in me. That's just so great. We just want to turn everybody from darkness to light, from Satan to God. Have an inheritance and forgiveness. That's the message. Some of you know the story of Cassie Bernal. Such a great story. Her mother was in her room one time looking for something, came across a stack of letters that had vulgar, inhuman kind of language and doodling art. She had been writing back and forth to her friend Mona. The art showed the girls murdering a teacher, vampire teeth, knives, magic spells, drugs, self-harm. All of this was in the letters, in the artwork, and even a satanic church where you have to drink the blood of kittens to join. And Cassie was all involved with this, and she's just a kid, and her mother sees this, and part of the art was a tombstone of Cassie's mother and Cassie's father, Ma and Pa Bernal. They're fantasizing about the deaths of their parents. Well, of course, Mrs. Bernal is alarmed, and she confronts Cassie about this when she comes home, and this leads to several weeks of Cassie crying and screaming and yelling, and things were just way out of control. She was not going to be controlled over this. So her dad finally set the record straight. He said, here's how it's going to be, Cassie. No freedom, no rights, no privileges, no trust. You're going to have to start right back at square one and earn all of those things back. She just lost all of her privileges. She was transferred out of her high school where all her negative influences were and placed in a private school. And she was totally cut off from her previous friends. No contact ever of any kind. Her parents regularly searched her room and her backpack. They said, you get no privacy, no rights. And if they found anything untoward, then there would be some sort of repercussions. But mostly, she knew she didn't have a chance because the search was on. The parents listened to every single phone conversation she had. And if she did anything wrong in her phone conversations, calling the old friends, then that's it. Now she has no phone, period. So she had to comply. She was never allowed to leave the house alone. Somebody went with her everywhere she went. At the Christian school, she had one friend named Jamie that she eventually attached herself to a little bit, but not much. And Jamie is talking about this. She said, a few times we talked about God, but she told me that she had like given her soul to Satan through one of her friends. And she said, there's no way I can love God. And I would tell her, that's not the way it has to be. Well, several months into her time at the Christian school, Jamie talked Cassie into coming on a weekend retreat with her and her church youth group. And so Cassie agreed to go. And Jamie is describing what it was like to watch Cassie at this retreat. Jamie says, the theme of the weekend was overcoming the temptations of evil and breaking out of the selfish life. There was a nighttime service, and it was the singing that for some reason broke down Cassie's walls. Cassie was pouring out all these things that she felt bad about and wanting to give them all up. I think she was asking God for forgiveness. And later I noticed that her whole face had changed. You looked at her, and even though she was still shy, it was like her eyes were more hopeful. See, something changed because of an encounter she had with the resurrected Jesus. Her mom says, at the end of that weekend, Brad, you know, mom and dad, Brad and I went to pick up Cassie. She came straight over to me, hugged me, then looked me in the eye and said, Mom, I've totally changed. I know you're not going to believe it, but I'll prove it to you. And her mom says, I was highly skeptical, but it really seemed to be true. From then on, her eyes were bright. She smiled again like she hadn't for years, and she began to treat us and her brother with genuine respect and affection. Of course, 2 years later, in April of 1999, two shooters walked into Columbine High School and shot Cassie dead and 12 students altogether. And so they only had good Cassie for two more years. But isn't that something? Paul said, I'm going to turn them, you know, the Lord Jesus is going to turn them from darkness to light and from the power of Satan to God. This has happened millions of times in millions of lives, to turn them from darkness to light, from Satan to God, to give them forgiveness, to be free, to give them forgiveness and inheritance forever by faith in the Lord Jesus. And so Cassie, of course, has a happy ending to her story because this is real. Agrippa said to Paul, you almost persuade me to be a Christian. Huh. When I hear that, I'm almost persuaded too. And then Paul said, I wish to God that not only you, but also all who hear me today were both almost and altogether just like me. Except I don't want you to have these bonds. But I wish that you weren't just almost persuaded. I wish you were all the way persuaded. Once you see the truth of the resurrected Christ, you can never go back to the same as you used to be. And that's why in chapter 26, verse 19, the Apostle Paul says, therefore, O King Agrippa, after I saw what I saw, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. I knew what I had to do. And that is where we close. The resurrection went to court. What we know for sure is that Messiah's resurrection happened. It changed everything about the world. The Old Testament had promised that Messiah would conquer death, and he did it. Jesus' truth is actually the thing that keeps people from madness. And therefore, when you've seen it, Paul said, oh, Agrippa, when I saw it, I was not disobedient to the heavenly vision. And so that's the question for all of us. Paul was not disobedient to what he knew was true. Are you disobedient to it? And I hope you'll say, I would not be disobedient to the heavenly vision.